Time for Tacky Talk once again here at Quincy Access Television. Checking in with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy to see what's going on in his world and on the world of the state. Hey, Tacky.
Hey, Joe. Good to see you. Glad to be back again for another week.
Yeah, boy, these weeks are flying. The 4th of July is knocking on the door here pretty soon.
Yeah, it's right around the corner, and it's going to be the first time in a long time I've not done a parade. Especially in Marymount, where they have one of the longer parades. I don't do Squanum, obviously, because I don't represent that area. But it's the first time in a long time, like Flag Day and Memorial Day and other festivities we have here we're not participating in. Although I'm sure the Quincy Police is getting a lot of phone calls about random fireworks at night. And I'm sorry to say, given the fact that we won't have our own fireworks in Boston, I suspect that people are going to self-indulge on their own entertainment, I think is the way to put it.
Yeah, it's really an issue up and down the East Coast, it seems. Just folks, I don't know if they're bored or want to have their own show because some of the shows have been canceled, but it's becoming an issue. It's becoming a safety issue as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Massachusetts is illegal to own or sell fireworks. So you see the billboards on the highway now, they remind people fireworks are illegal in possession and sale. However, our neighbors in northern New Hampshire, it is legal to buy fireworks, and we don't have border checks. So as a result, people bring them down or they acquire them from other out-of-state folks, but most likely New Hampshire because of geography. So
yeah,
everybody knows they've heard small fireworks and small rockets go off. I mean, not unusual, but having it go off every night, and especially in dense urban areas, I hear Dorchester in particular has been getting a lot of fireworks then, which is disturbing people. From sleeping and just generally trying to get some rest in this very challenging period of mental health.
That's exactly right. It's a key is to get good rest for sure. So what has happened in the past week on Beacon Hill in the 2nd Norfolk District that we should talk about?
I got nothing exactly for the 2nd Norfolk District, I think you might have said, but it's still been somewhat busy. Obviously, we're not going to have a budget in place by July 1st. We passed a 1/12 budget, which is using last year's budget numbers for 1 month of funding for the month of July as we try to still determine what our projections are for the FY21 revenue. We still have a very cloudy picture because as the state reopens, we still don't know what the tax revenue is going to look like. We've also done a lot of things on deferring penalties, fees, late payments. A lot of that stuff has been deferred as well. So it's hard for us to do a calculation when we don't actually know what the calculation looks like. And it's still a federal component. So we don't know what the federal government is or is not going to provide for additional assistance for the states. So we're kind of waiting it out to see how that goes. So in the stopgag, we at least will have a one-month budget in place. The government will still continue to run, but we just don't know. The projections have been as high now as over $6 billion lost for next year.
$6 billion with a B.
With a B for the state, potentially. People don't realize that about 2/3 of the state government is funded by state dollars, so that's a combination of taxes, fees, penalties, settlement agreements, things like that. And 1/3 of the budget is composed of federal reimbursements or assistance. So for programs like Medicare, Medicaid, which you know is MassHealth, that program is federally reimbursed. We pay part, they pay part. So we have a lot of those grant programs. FEMA money, which is what funds MEMA, that's a reimbursement from the federal government. So while we do get some grants, a lot of stuff is that the state floats the money in front with the expectation the feds are going to pay us back. So even though our budget's 2/3 really state funded, because be mindful of the fact that 2/3 part of the money's floated out so we can get our 1/3 back from the feds on some of these things. The House and Senate did pass the Chapter 90 bond bill for cities and towns to have local bridge and road work money for fiscal year 21. There's a disagreement. The Senate funded it $300 million and the House funded it at $200 million. So what does that mean for Quincy? At the $300 million number, it's approximately $2.9 million. At the $200 million number, it's approximately $1.9 million. So the discrepancy between the House and Senate is a disagreement regarding insuring payment of bonds. we have a bit of a philosophical issue. So the House has adopted, given the current uncertain times, that if we're going to start bonding more out, we have to ensure that we can pay our debts. And this is going to be, I think, a bit of a philosophical issue for a while as we try to work on compromise.
Interesting that that the House is more conservative this time around. Is that a switch from the typical way legislation works?
Actually, historically speaking, not just in my time, but well before my time, the House historically has been more fiscal conservative body than the Senate. It's just different political dynamics, quite frankly. The geography of the districts are different. The makeup of the communities of each district is different from the senators and the representatives. So if you pull up the maps for the state senators and state representatives and start looking at the way the composition is for each of those districts, you'll find that it's very different in terms of philosophy. It's one thing when you have a thinking group of 40,000 people. It's another thing when you have a thinking group of 160,000.
Yeah.
So it is, I think people don't always understand the complexity and the differences that occur, that once you get to a bigger district, it's a very different mindset as a collective constituency.
I know for the 1.9 million, that's essentially what the city usually gets for the Chapter 70 funding. So it would be an extra $1 million under the Senate plan. Is that right?
Yeah, under the Senate plan it would. I mean, the Chapter 90 funding historically has been around $200 or $300 million, depending on the fiscal year. Some days we're able to be a little more generous, some days not so much. And that amount of money is bonded by the state. It is not borne by the cities and towns. So from our standpoint, while it is great to get assistance to cities and towns, we do have to be very mindful of the fact that it's on our bond cap, not the city's bond cap. And it will be outside of our debt limit. We do have a debt spending limit, so we intentionally put that outside the debt limit so it doesn't affect other capital projects in the state level. So even though interest rates are low, given uncertain times, we still want to be helpful, but we're going to be mindful as well.
So would that delay or halt any projects in Quincy that you know of?
Unlikely, I would think. I mean, a lot of times it's not always guaranteed that you know how much Chapter 90 you're going to get per year. So given the fact that same towns in the state are also still trying to manage their own budgets, given the fiscal uncertainty, I'm sure people are not going to pay the property taxes on time. I'm sure excise taxes are going to come in on delays as well with many folks on the local level, given the fact that unemployment's in the almost 16% in the state.
Yeah.
Opening is a slow go right now as everyone's trying to do this safely. I do think there's a lot of challenges associated with all of us on leading our services for our constituents.
Yeah, well, I think, we can learn some lessons from what's going on in other parts of the country that opened up before us and are now seeing infection rates surge.
Yeah, according to the news yesterday, Texas has halted the reopening for the moment as they've now seen two consecutive day record surge and their hospital capacity is nearing 100%. I've not had a chance to look at what they've done for preparation. For those who don't know, Massachusetts had increased our entire hospital capacity by another 100%. So our capacity in Massachusetts was 200% over norm. Well, actually 200% total, it was 100% over norm. So we kept the field hospitals and other prep centers and preparing the community health centers for overflow surge. And
yeah, I know Milton Hospital, they were exclusively COVID patients at one point in Milton.
And if the governor needed to, he would take the, he would, by emergency power, just take over doctors groups or PPP, the pharmacy plan places, like the hybrid programs, PPE plans.
Oh, yes. Those,
they would start commandeering more if things got really, really bad.
But, sure.
I think people underappreciate the sheer volume of capacity we created in Massachusetts in a very short period of time under a whole lot of stress on our medical providers, our public safety folks, and of course the support staff over those hospitals. I mean, people that serve food, people who keep the place clean, people who do the accounting, people who do administrative work, people who fill out the paperwork. I mean, a whole lot of people had to create this overcapacity.
Those are the essential workers that they keep talking about, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of folks that are out there that you don't see in the news that keep the wheels running. I'm not sure these other states around us have prepared for overcapacity like we did. And thankfully, we didn't get to 200% capacity, but it's good that we were ready to go. And we'll continue to be in a readiness position regardless until a of cure or therapy is out there that we can better manage the disease.
Yeah, we're seeing, I think it's New York, Connecticut, implementing quarantines now for people coming from out of state. Of course, it's always happened, been in existence here in Massachusetts, the quarantine mandate or suggestion, if you will.
Yeah, Florida actually early on had rejected residents from New York from coming into the state as part of the New York surge. And we get it. I mean, that's reasonable. We do have foreign-bound travels as overseas travel tries to figure out to reopen up. The EU countries are still not allowing U.S. residents to come over yet. And we're not the only ones. We've not been singled out. There's a lot of places around the world with major problems, especially Central and South America at this stage. That have travel bans on coming back and forth. We've done the same as well as a matter of personal safety.
Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, we're not a martial law country. I mean, people want to start forcing bans and quarantines and closing our state borders, then you're asking for martial law.
Right.
And we've never reached that point.
Yeah. I wanted to get your take, Jackie, on the state's guidance for schools going back into classrooms in the fall and what you think about it.
I think there's going to be a lot of conversations between parents, school committee members, administrators, teachers regarding how they're going to implement this. Other countries have implemented what the governor's suggesting, 3 to 6 foot distance spaces, partitions if available, orderly movement of children through the school system in terms of contact with each other and so forth. And, you know, the WCVB news last night poll showed a fairly even split between parents about their fear of safety of the children as part of going back to school. There are very few studies out there about children and COVID. We know that there are a lower probability of infection, lower probability of severeness, and very low probability of death. But, you know, it's whether they carry stuff back to you. So not having children, but many friends with kids, you know, it's always the same story. My kid went to school and I came back with, you know, a virus and then the whole family's got it.
Yep.
And the kid bounces back in 2 days and Rusty is sick for a week.
Yeah.
So
or in this case, infecting the teachers too and the staff that are older, you know. Yeah.
So absolutely. So, you know, we've all have friends. You most likely people will listen to families know exactly what I'm talking about. But I'm not a family. So I do hear from other people.
Yeah.
So I think it's implementable. I do think it's going to be a lot of work. I do agree it's going to be some additional cost.
Yep.
Require a lot of cooperation. I mean, families have to cooperate with the school system, and school system have to cooperate with families and teachers to try to make this work properly. And I think it's a big part of it. The idea of having online learning and in-classroom learning at the same time may be a bit of a challenge to implement because it's harder to answer a child's question online while having kids in the class at the same time.
Yeah.
The logistics is a bit harder as opposed to everyone in the same format. So time is short. July 1st is around the corner next week. So, I mean, even though it seems like you have 2 months, it's going to move really fast.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know here in Quincy, the mayor is already trying to implement some of the guidelines in terms of just logistics in the classrooms and acquiring PPE. You know, I know the state set aside some money for districts to help them do that, but it's going to be a busy summer for them for sure.
Yeah, and there's a huge psychological toll on all of us, especially children who at an age needs to engage in a lot of socialization, the importance of spending time with friends, the importance of being able to, play with each other. Literally, I mean, you know, it's hard to play if you can't touch. I mean, freeze tag was a big deal. Very easy game to play. You don't need a whole lot of tools associated with it.
Laser tag, I suppose.
You have to get some kind of like throw a beanbag at a kid. I have no idea. You don't want to engage in people tossing stuff at people.
Right.
But I mean, this is part of socialization of kids, right? You know, playing sports, you know, hugging, sharing items together. I mean, this is an important part for children. And hopefully as adults, we can remember those lessons. You know, like I say, it's going to require a lot of cooperation from everyone. I have a hard time, you know, seeing how a second grader is going to be able to keep a mask on all day. I mean, it's hard enough as an adult. So
I agree. Yeah.
You know, and it's nothing wrong. It's like I said, it's not the children. It's just how it is. I mean, you just have to work with the situation.
Yeah. I mean, in reading on some of the material from the pandemic back in 1918, I mean, that went on really for about 2 years, you know, before things kind of went back to normalcy. So we could be in this for the long haul.
That's correct. And that was a time before modern travel. We didn't have airplanes. You didn't have trains to move with the capacity of public transit. Miraculously, with the capacity we do. A lot of people didn't have cars to go between states. Most people spend a lot of time within their geographic zones. So to give you an idea how a disease that infected something in the estimate like one third of the planet with no modern travel we enjoy today gives an idea how a disease can spread and you know how lack of early identification of what you're dealing with resulted in death. Thankfully, we have modern medicine and we've been able to respond better. But I think a lot of our early information, again, I mean, I relied on what everyone else did at the beginning of this pandemic about what we were told. You know, we were told it's kind of like the flu, it's not as dangerous, it really hurts the older population worse. You know, that was what we had back in March. Mm-hmm. And now it's June and everything we were told in March, what we're dealing with is not what it was. It's definitely different. So
everybody's susceptible for sure. And it strikes everybody differently, it appears. You know, some have no symptoms, some are extremely symptomatic, most are somewhere in the middle. So it's hard to predict.
Yeah, we'll be using the SARS protocol for the most part as our baseline for this disease. And if you go back to my last interview with Mark Crosby back in March before this all hit, I mean, everything I said in that interview is no longer accurate because that's what I knew then, and this is what I know now. So this is actually somewhat frustrating, as you can imagine, as we try to provide accurate information, but accurate information will change.
You can imagine for folks in the medical profession how frustrating, you know, they're at an accelerated learning curve here, trying to figure it out and find a cure at the same time.
Absolutely. And they have enormous challenges in communicating that information to us and us to try to communicate to you. It is not easy.
Yeah.
I would suspect that if you go back into the archives and look at some of my older interviews, you're going to find that what I said then and what I said now are very two different things.
Sure. Can we talk a little bit about the social justice issues that are going on, Tacky, and specifically the governor's reform bill and the $5,000 incentive for police officers to get extra training, which seems to have riled some feathers.
Yeah, I can imagine why. If you're anybody, the idea that you should pay people to get training to do their jobs. So let me see, I can frame this all taking up a half hour. The Asian Caucus and Black Leader Caucus had a meeting this week, and it was actually a very productive meeting. We did a resume about 30 minutes discussing options associated with police reform. We've agreed to have more conversations going to next week on ideas being back and forth by email, essentially. We're going to just throw ideas at each other and see what we can agree upon. The governor's proposal requires certification training for all police officers in the state. The training will be paid by the taxpayers. There is no training or licensing fee. So unlike being a lawyer, a cosmetology, electrolysis, massage, electrician, plumber, and any other number of professions out there that requires a license, there is no licensing fee in this. And even though those professions require you to be licensed to practice profession, you know, the government's proposing a licensing structure for police officers with no licensing fee. But on the opposite, as you pointed out, you get paid extra money to do something you've been told to do, but you don't have to pay for it. So I think the public isn't loving this idea, as you can imagine. I'm not getting positive responses from constituents on this idea. Because if you're a licensed profession, especially if you're a licensed profession, you know, why am I paying my licensing fee when someone else doesn't have? There's a certification process under very specific circumstances, but that does not mean termination of the police officer. You just need decertification. So that means you can still be on police payroll, but you can't be a police officer. However, there is nothing that says you cannot be recertified in his proposal. So let's assume you have a really bad person who decertifies. It's not clear to me if this legislation actually means that you cannot not recertify. It doesn't mean that you cannot be certified again in the future. It's not clear to me about that exactly. Mm-hmm. Thinking maybe something in there, but reading it, I'm still trying to find that language exactly that says you can never come back. Secondly, it doesn't mean that the police officer that's decertified loses their job on the police force because it doesn't fire anybody.
Okay,
that's still up to the decision of the police department.
So essentially, they could just be moved to desk duty, if you will.
That's correct. And they'll still be part of the union, and they still have pay, depending on how that union structure is in different, you know, it's different in terms of different union structures. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's that provisions in there. It does create a very, very large oversight committee, 14 members, of which seven are from various law enforcement, and seven is from people of color, defined as a minority business. So use the definition of small business, minority owned as the definition for the seven members of color on that committee. So it's a very large and unruly committee. It doesn't address a lot of issues that I'm getting constituent emails and calls on. I'm well into like probably closing 150 people contact me with this, very concerned about police reform and desiring changes they want. So it doesn't really address a lot of those other issues that have been brought up by those constituents. Everyone has a different opinion and standouts on it, and we're going to try to reach some kind of consensus on a lot of different people hitting us at the local level, what they want to see and what is actually reasonable to do.
Hmm. Do you think there should be a permanent residency requirement for police officers? You know, they live in the community in which they work.
Well, that limits your pool of applicants, right? If you're in a very small community of less than 5,000 people, you don't really have a lot of choices there.
True.
Or you're forced to be able to move in. I've always been very hesitant on residency requirements because I think there might be issue because the U.S. Constitution allows freedom of movement, and the Commerce Clause allows people to move between places to work. So that can be a problem. I'm always surprised Boston has not been challenged on a regular basis regarding its residency requirement. Because it limits the pool. And then, you know, there's also different costs of living. One of the challenges of places like Boston and the rent requirement is that government doesn't pay enough money.
Mm.
So, if, you know, you living in Boston, you know, you want to work in city government, it can be very challenging. Boston is not a cheap place to live. So, you know, unless you're, what was the count last time? 2 years ago, it's been a little while, the data, but 2 years ago, if you're a single person in Boston trying to live by yourself as a rental with no car, you need about $90,000, you know, to live on your own. No car, no saving money, just to meet the rent, the food, a cell phone, you know, just the basics.
Yeah. Median income, it's not $90,000, I'm sure.
No, I mean, we do know that certain administrators make a lot more money. We do know that police officers, because of overtime, make a lot more money. But the vast majority of public employees are not making $90,000.
Either, right.
Especially in municipal level regarding places like Boston. So, you know, I understand why people like the idea, but you also have to think about scale. So a bigger community has a bigger pool of options to draw upon, a small one does not. And also it could inhibit minority hires if you need them, if you have special skill sets. And, you know, also may prohibit women from being able to hire because of geographical limitations. So if your community only has men that apply, well, it's hard to diversify if the only applicants in your area are men and all the women are not allowed in. Conversely, if you're looking for specific skill sets and these persons have the skill set that lives in the community next door, that can limit your hiring pool also.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So it is, I mean, it's just a proposal right now, is that right? It has not been enacted by either members of the House or the Senate?
No, it's a bill the governor filed, so I suspect that's a starting point conversation bill. I'm not saying that bill is going to pass, but we need a conversation point. Most people, you know, have to put something on the table to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I don't have anything to put on the table to agree or disagree upon, there's no conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So at least the governor's now put something on the table for myself and my colleagues to talk among ourselves and listen to our constituents and other folks that email and write to me, whether or not, even they're not constituents, I'm getting a lot of information from them too. Now we have the ability to say, hey, you know, this is a start point. Do we like it? Do we not like it? Should we change it? Should we scrap it and, you know, move something off? You know, at least we now have a starting point.
Yeah. I want to ask you, Tacky, and I know this will open up an hours long conversation. We have like 5 minutes, but should the state be doing more to, number one, implement safety procedures at nursing homes, and number two, create new safety procedures at nursing homes?
All right, you're talking about Holyoke.
Yes.
So the Joint Committee on Elder Affairs at the state, the legislature has been doing investigations in nursing homes since the pandemic really began. And as you've seen in the news, 63% plus of all deaths are people in nursing facilities, and it's immensely tragic. If you read the Holyoke report, it's 174 pages total with all the supporting documentations. I've gone through probably about 25% of it so far. Okay. Get that read. It's horrible. It's horrible. It's actually horrible. They never implemented the hiring of a director with the right skill sets. They were exempted by all kinds of other state regulations that other nursing homes are required to keep to. There was an audit in 2019, which I know it's 2019 and the pandemic hit in March 2020, but you know, there was no real movement on implementing those recommended changes from the last audit. The Secretary of Veterans was supposed to hire someone in 2016 that met the new state requirements for a director, which didn't materialize. A lot of stuff needs to change. And, you know, it's available, you know, documents available online if people want to try to move through it. But this independent pool is extraordinarily thorough. Over 100 interviews, people, well into 111 individual interviews, text messages, emails, they went through everything.
Yeah.
So absolutely, I mean, more needs to be done. And when the governor said in his press conference, well, the administrator, one of the criteria of hiring administrator at soldiers' homes should be someone with experience in long-term care facilities. I'm like, why should that be a criteria? That should be a mandatory requirement.
Right.
I still get nervous when I hear things like that. I'm like, why should that be just a criteria? That should be like, yes, must be. So I don't know why the governor would say something like that. It makes me extremely nervous.
Shall we end with the census again?
Yes. You know, we are doing better. Massachusetts continues to be ahead of the national average with 63.7%. The national average is 61.7%. Quincy is slowly ticking up with 62.6%. Let me look at the chart here next to me. We're doing a little bit better. We went up 0.2 points. So that's a good go. Our neighbors continue very well. Weymouth is at 70%. Granger is at 74.3%. Randolph is at 64.8%. Milton's at 78.3%. So, you know, they're all moving to the C, except for Randolph. Everyone's moving into the C zone. We're doing great in places like Marina Bay and West Quincy by the golf course. And thank you to my constituents in Housneck and Adam Shore. They've come up really high, as well as my neighbors here in Walston. But places like Germantown is on track to meet the 2010 numbers, but we could still do better. And the hot parts of the city that seems to be very challenged are the Brewers Corner area, Spring Hill area, the new developments in Quincy Center, parts of High Point. You know, a lot, everything in Crown Colony because of those new apartments down there at Appalachian. So, right. I mean, areas have been very slow in response. I am aware that the census is now already higher and continue to hire folks. So, if people looking for some part time work, go to the census website, see what's available. We can get some phone calls soon. People are going to be doing some phone call outreach this starting right about January 1st ish. Mm-hmm. You should start getting some calls. So, again, they will not ask for your social security number. Again, they will not ask for your bank account number. They will not ask for your name or your favorite pet, your mother's maiden name, where you went to school. They're not asking for anything. They're going to give you a website to go to the census. If you cannot do that, there's a whole verification process on their end to help you on the phone to do that. It is up in a number of different languages. If you need linguistic assistance, when they call you, tell them you do, and we'll find someone to help you. So, again, we will never ask for bank account or personal information that can create a fake identity. The person, because if they do, hang up on them.
Right. It's a fraud, yeah. 2020census.gov is the main website. And to get a hold of you, Tacky, how do they do that?
Again, give a call to the office at 617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. The staff tells me it's been the most effective way to reach us, actually.
Okay.
They find it's actually the best way to do that as the staff pick up voicemails. You can obviously reach me at tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. The staff tells me that's great, but they like the phone calls more. My website at tackychin.org has a lot of information you may not even have to phone me on, because the information may be there you can find, as well as my Facebook site does do summaries of the governor's press conferences, other important phone numbers, lots of graphics that you can download onto your computer or your phone that, you know, in case you need to call someone. So just scroll down the Facebook feed. I know it takes forever these days because there's so much stuff, but
right.
We'll find some information there before you even need to contact us.
Okay. Nice to see you again, Tacky.
Thank you, Joe, and I look forward to seeing you again next week.
Yep, absolutely. Until then, be well.
You too. Be well, be safe.